So some of us just came back from sitting a weekend retreat, Memorial Day weekend retreat at Jokoji, which is a marvelous little Zen center up on Skyline. And if you know Long Ridge Preserve, one of the open space preserves, it's right in the middle of it, and it's a lovely place. It's kind of protected by the preserve all around and has its own little pond. Actually, it's not little, it's a big pond. And very rustic. It was built originally as a alternative high school in maybe the 60s. The Quakers built it, and it was known as Pacific High School. And it was apparently, it was pretty alternative. It was probably one of the more alternative, wild high schools in the country at the time. And then in some ways, the buildings haven't changed. A little bit they've changed, but you get kind of this little flavor of that time. The alternative 60s a little bit. And you feel like you're very close to the woods there, because the meditation hall kind of is up on a, kind of part of it's up on a platform. You're up in the tree, up into the trees almost. And the trees come close to the meditation hall. And it's lovely to be there, partly because of being in the wilderness and the nature and the simplicity of the place. I think it's very, very helpful and conducive for practice. Some people don't think it's a little bit too rustic. But I love it up there. And being at the Zen Center, at that Zen Center this weekend, I found myself giving a lot of Zen stories, talking a lot about Suzuki Roshi. I never met Suzuki Roshi, but I've practiced for many years and with his students. Many years I practiced at the San Francisco Zen Center. And so I want to kind of continue or pick up on some of the things I was saying on the retreat that come from Suzuki Roshi. And that's why I went up to get this. This was given to us at the our opening here at IMC a year ago, last January. And it's a calligraphy by Suzuki Roshi. And then it's a photograph of the calligraphy. And it's Suzuki Roshi writing the characters for beginner's mind. And he's very famous for this little expression, beginner's mind. And it was given to us by Mel Weitzman, who was a student of Suzuki Roshi. Mel had it for many years in his own office. And he took it down off his wall to give it to us here. And so I'm very happy with it. And we still haven't installed it. We should do that now, someplace. So Suzuki Roshi, at least for the West, in America, kind of coined the word beginner's mind. And the importance of it, the importance of having this fresh mind, this willing to see things new always, putting aside your preconceived ideas about how things are, what can be done, what's going on, and being able to see things in a new way. And he was a little bit, the contrast was against the expert's mind, which, the analogy doesn't work so well if you push it too much, but the analogy is the expert is someone who knows what's what. And you can't do it a different way. And we've all probably had that kind of experience of going to someone who says, "Oh, no, I can't do that." And they're the expert. And then there is another way. And because the beginner sometimes can see it. So they have this beginner's mind. And so they named the San Francisco Zen Center on Page Street in San Francisco. The name of the temple there, the Buddhist name that's hardly ever used, is Hoshinji, which means beginner's mind temple. It's a place to have beginner's mind. So there's a story about Suzuki Roshi in the Zendo one day. The way I kind of understood the story was, I'm not sure exactly how it happened, unfolded, but how I remember it being told, is some people I think were about to leave the Zendo or leave Suzuki Roshi to go someplace and do something. In any case, Suzuki Roshi said, "The most important thing is..." And then there was this long pause. And that woke people up. They'd been studying with Suzuki Roshi for some time. And to be told, in Zen, you're really trying to understand, the true nature of reality and have your Kensho and Satori and really see into the depths of what Buddhism is really... In Zen, it's a little bit enigmatic. It's a little bit hard sometimes to understand. So finally he was going to tell you the most important thing. So everybody kind of paused and waited to hear what this thing was. So then he repeated, the most important thing is searching for the most important thing. And it can seem like a cruel joke to say that. But I think it wasn't meant as a joke. I think he meant to offer something very significant. And there's maybe many ways of understanding it. Maybe some of you will offer your understandings. But one of the understandings is that it's the very search for the truth, the search for understanding of what's really happening, the practice of searching is, in a sense, the fulfillment of the search, or the fulfillment of being a human being, or the fulfillment of practice. At least in Soto Zen, which is a particular kind of Buddhist tradition, the idea that your sincere endeavoring in the practice itself is a fulfillment of the practice. So you're not obsessed or consumed with the idea of trying to get some kind of goal beyond this moment of practice here. And in fact, to kind of have some kind of long-term goal for the practice, and it's so easy for that to cloud the mind, cloud the present moment, and get interfere with really waking up and being fully awake here and now. And so the process, being fully awake is not so easy to do, but the practice of endeavoring to do that, the endeavoring to wake up and to be present, that is the fulfillment of the practice. So to search for the most important thing is the most important thing. And heaven forbid you ever find out what an important thing is, because then you get complacent. Then you would stop searching. Then you start doing this wonderful thing, of looking. And that kind of emphasis in Buddhism that the practice is important more than almost the realization is, again, particular to the Soto Zen tradition of Mahayana. And it's somewhat different from our own tradition here at IMC, a Theravadan tradition. But I think that there's something very profound in the Soto Zen approach, and it's well worth kind of considering a little bit. And this reminded me of a story that Lou Richman has told me, and maybe he's told you, he's come down here and taught for us sometimes, of asking Suzuki Roshi if he practiced, could he expect to get enlightened? And Suzuki Roshi's answer was, if your practice is sincere, it's almost as good as getting enlightened. There's something about the sincere endeavoring, sincere engagement in the practice, that is almost as good as being enlightened. And I've known people who have had some experience of enlightenment, some taste of it, and it was marvelous for them in some ways, but it didn't really polish their character completely. And in fact, sometimes it led them to become a little bit arrogant. Look at me, And sometimes people then stop practicing. Oh, look, I got something here. And I got some understanding, some realization, And they stop practicing, and then they settle into their complacency or their arrogance or their surety. They think they really know how things are. Another one of Suzuki Roshi's teachings, and there's a recent book by him that was given this title, was at one point he offered to define Soto Zen in three words. And so kind of, Buddhism or Zen in a nutshell. And the words were, not always so. Now, you have this great world religion, Zen, and Buddhism, and it can be all boiled down to not always so. But I think it's a very profound thing, not always so. It certainly is a kind of a rephrasing of one of the central realizations of Buddhism, emphasis in Buddhism, is the emphasis on impermanence. And impermanence is really at the foundation of Buddhist teaching, Buddhist doctrine, Buddhist practice, Buddhist realization. Somehow a radical coming to terms, a radical penetration of the world of impermanence. So not always so. Things are always changing. You can't expect things to always be so. But I think it has other meanings also, not always so. When you come to some understanding of how things are, it might be true for that moment. But it's not always going to be so. And so this beginner's mind that's always ready to let go of your fixed understanding of how things are, and be open to other possibilities coming in. That things might not always be so. And so the next day, you don't expect that, you know, that the bus you've been taking every morning at 8 o'clock, you know, you're not so disappointed, so surprised when it doesn't show up. Because after all, you kind of expect it's not always going to be so. There's some expectation that life is always changing. It's not all, you can't depend for consistency in life, for constancy, that things are always going to be the same. Not always so. And so part of the ease or the peace in life, the kind of the wise living that Suzuki Roshi was pointing to, was carrying with you this little bit of this attitude, not always so. There's a marvelous story that is told many times about Jan Cha having a favorite cup of tea, his beautiful cup, beautiful teacup. And someone may be challenging him at one point about, you know, how is it, and you're a great enlightened master, and how is it you could be kind of attached to that cup of tea, that teacup? And he said, no, I'm not attached to it. It's my favorite cup, I like it. But in my mind, it's as if it's already been broken. You know, so he's appreciating while it's there, but he's not holding on to it. He sees its impermanence. So you know, I think as often in religions, in Buddhism, people are looking for some kind of certainty. They're looking for some understanding. Now I really know what the truth is. They're looking for the truth. And it's sometimes very relieving to have someone tell you what it is. And some people will carry it around, some religious doctrine or creed or belief, and as much in Buddhism as other religions, and hold on to, this is the truth, now I really know. And it's kind of okay if you hold on for yourself, but then you bug your neighbors. You know, this is the way it is, you know, you tell them. And Suzuki Roshi says, not always so. It's not always so. And I think, I believe, and when he talked about not always so, he even said, this is not always so. So what does that leave you with? So they have this openness that's not always so, and not to fix on, has some, and not to settle on some fixed view and idea of how things should be or how things are. They have beginner's mind. And this idea of, you know, sincere practice is almost as good as enlightenment. It's kind of like this beginner's mind, not always so, to kind of see what's happening now, what's true now at this moment. So one of the very important ideas in Soto Zen, as I encountered it, as I learned from my teachers, is encapsulated in a term, a Japanese term called Genjo Koan. And Thomas Cleary, who's translated a lot of Zen literature, translates Genjo Koan as the issue at hand. And that's where I got the title for that book of mine, which is on the table, The Issue at Hand. But the Genjo Koan is understood. Koan is an enigmatic question or statement that Zen masters make or have recorded and saved in their books. And then you're supposed to grapple with this enigmatic statement. Does a dog have Buddha nature? Why did Bodhidharma come from the West? What's the sound of one hand clapping? There's a whole, it's hundreds and hundreds of these kinds of statements. And so a Zen student is supposed to grapple with this and come to some kind of resolution, some kind of realization, some kind of transformation through this kind of grappling with this kind of statement or question. So that's what a koan is. And Genjo means something like that which is being actualized in the present moment. So the koan of what's being actualized in the present moment. So it's the question you have, you carry with you, what is this? Every moment, you carry with you this question, what is this? What's going on now? With this fresh mind, this beginner's mind, as if you've never seen it before. There was a study done in the 60s, a psychological study, I suppose it's called that, of where they wired up different meditators with electrodes to see what happens to their brain waves. And they did this to Zen monks in Japan, and they did it to meditators in India, Hindu meditators, Hinduism and yoga traditions in India. And one of the interesting differences that they saw between the Zen monks who had many years of meditation background and these people doing other meditation practices was that they would have them go into the meditative state, and then they would ring a bell. This little ding. And then, I don't know how much later, 10 seconds or maybe a minute later, they ring a bell again. Bing. And they measure what happened to the brain waves. And with the non-Zen meditators, after a while, as you kind of expect for a human being, the mind got habituated to that sound. And with time, there was less and less a response in the brainwaves. First, there was a big, you know, movement in the brainwaves, and then less and less and less and less, until finally there was no, you could ring the bell, and there was no reaction at all. In a Zen monk, there was no habituation going on. Every time there was the bell was rung, it was like it was being heard for the first time. The brainwaves would move. So, in some ways, it sounds like, you know, wonderful. You know, just freshness, always meeting something fresh. Some of you might think, oh, gee, you know, it's like the irritation of the drop dripping from the sink, you know. You want to be habituated, you know. But this idea of being fresh and kind of beginner's mind, seeing something new. The Genjo Koan, what is this? What is this? What's happening now? There is a kind of Zen kind of koan, a little story that's told of a monk who goes to a Zen master in China. And this is a venerable old master. I guess he's been teaching and practicing for decades. And so the monk asks him, what's the teaching of a lifetime? You know, after all this lifetime of teaching and practice, can you give me like one real teaching? You know, essential teaching, something. And the Zen master answer is, an appropriate response. You know, again, all of Buddhism is going to be condensed, you know, into some essential, pithy kind of statement, truth. And he says, an appropriate response. It doesn't give you much to hang on to, does it? Except it is an encouragement to this Genjo Koan, to this question, you know, what is this? What's the appropriate response here? And this is a very valuable part of the Zen training that I got, is that understanding what reality is in this moment, understanding myself in this moment, the insight that can come with practice, is not enough just to have insight. There needs at some point to be a response to the world. Or some people say, the manifestation of your insight, a manifestation of your compassion, of your love. That the realization is only half the story. The other half is the manifestation of it in the world. And, it's one thing to feel, you know, boundless love for all humanity in the privacy of your own house. You don't have to face anybody. And it's something else to manifest it to your neighbor and to your, you know, family and to the people, strangers and difficult people in your lives, to manifest it, to do something with it. It's one thing to discover freedom. Sometimes people can sit in meditation and experience great states of freedom where they can let go of so many things that preoccupy us, concern us, worry us, things we're afraid of. And it can be very, very relieving, very liberating feeling, a wonderful feeling in meditation to feel this freedom. And the Zen teachers will say, that's fine. And they'll kind of yawn, you know, I've heard that before. They say, you know. And they say, well, that's fine, but let's see how you manifest it. Can you manifest that freedom in your life? Can you be that free as you engage in the activities of your life? Remember, I asked a Zen teacher once, how do you know if someone's enlightened? And he said, you watch them for a long time and see if they're helpful to other people. And I thought that was a very nice answer. I was inspired by the answer. It's an inadequate answer. Not always so, right? But it was a great answer. And there was a bumper sticker up there at the retreat. I remember, I'd never seen before. Maybe you've seen it before. I don't remember it exactly. But the bumper sticker said something like, happiness comes from taking care of others, or cherish others. Remember what it said?
Yeah, it's Kent Sigmund's.
What did it say?
To be happy, cherish others.
Yeah, to be happy, cherish others. To be happy, care for others, you know. And so this manifestation. And the beautiful thing is that as, you know, the degree of a realization, or the degree of freedom that we attain through practice or love or compassion we can experience, you know, it comes in degrees. And you might feel experience just a little bit, maybe just a hint of it at first. And but then if you try to manifest it, that both tests your understanding, your realization, your what's come, but also the attempt to manifest it is a kind of feedback loop where it actually reinforces or develops or helps what happens in meditation. And what happens in meditation then reinforces the manifestation. And they go wonderfully. It's a wonderful way of kind of building in practice. And practice then can build a lot faster if you know, you're both the manifesting aspect is happening and the realizing aspect. So an appropriate response. So what is the appropriate response? So in Soto Zen, there's the idea that there's never any end to your practice. And they might recognize that a person has an enlightenment experience and has a great enlightenment experience, but they'll never think that that's the end of your practice. Because your response to the world, your responding to the world, is always, the world's always changing. It's always something new. The person that you've known every day of your life, next morning when you wake up, is really a different person. And are you still treating the person as you've always treated the person? Or are you willing to kind of have the beginner's mind and, you know, meet the person new? You don't know what's happened to that person overnight. And so this beginner's mind, this, you know, searching, what's the appropriate response here? Given that the person might be new, be different. So since the world's always changing, always, so the practice of finding the appropriate response, the practice of finding the expression of freedom, expression of compassion and love in any particular situation is always changing, always takes a different form. So in Soto Zen, there's no end to practice because practice is that manifestation. In our kind of Theravada tradition, there's often much more the sense that there's an end to practice. And people who get fully enlightened, there's an expression that they say, they've done what had to be done. So, you know, then they're kind of enlightened retirement. I think it's not so different, the traditions. It's just they have different ways of talking, different emphasis. And in fact, enlightened people in Thailand and different places are very much engaged in responding to the world. You know, the ones I've met, seemingly, have a kind of freshness to them where they don't kind of see things always in a new way. And, I mean, in the same way, but really ready to see things new and fresh and not holding to fixed views and doctrines. So what does it take to have a beginner's mind? What is it? What do you have to relax? What do you have to let go of? What do you have to free yourself from in order to have a beginner's mind? In order to meet the next moment freshly and be interested in it. Say, what is this? What is this? And I've kind of learned, I'm still having to learn this lesson, but I've learned it somewhat painfully at times in my life where I've encountered someone that I know, and maybe sometimes when I haven't even known them, but had some assumption about who they were based on past experience. And then treated them that way. And it kind of, normally would have been okay, but I wasn't tuned into the fact that something had happened to them. A friend of theirs had just died or something. And it happened once. And I was treating them as if, you know, I hadn't taken the moment to see, what's new with this person? What's the appropriate response here? What's the new thing that's occurred here? But I was operating on old idea of what was happening, who the person was, and what the situation was. So, what does it take to meet your day fresh, meet the next person fresh, new, next moment? What do you have to let go of? What ideas of security? What ideas of identity? Of who you are, who you think you have to be? Do you have to let go of and relax. Not always so implies to yourself, who are you? You finally, you know, it's a great search to find out who you are, and you finally, I know who I am now. And then you hear Suzuki Roshi saying, not always so. You know, you wake up next morning. It's not the person you've been living with your whole life, but it's you. Are you the same person as you were the day before? How do you know? What gives you the idea of constancy, of continuity, that you are the same person as you were the day before? Upon what authority do you take that to be the case? Has anybody told you that? It's not in the manual of being a human being that you're supposed to be the same. Maybe you're changed. And some of you are old enough to probably have seen yourself change quite a bit over the years. I've seen myself change. And it's quite interesting to see yourself change. And sometimes it's interesting to go back to places where you've been many years ago and see yourself, you know, how much you have changed and how you see things new. And I find it's a little bit humbling for myself to have to see the past changes and wonder what's happening now. How am I changing now that I don't see? Because I'm sure it's happening in ways they don't even see. So the idea is that meditation is supposed to help with this process of meeting things fresh, letting go of old assumptions and biases and preconceived ideas, and being willing to let go and just be present. What is the appropriate response now? What is it to be present now? What's the Genjo Koan now? What's the issue at hand now? And one of the lessons I got from Zen practice was, in order to really do this thoroughly and well in meditation practice, it's really best to let go of ideas of goals and accomplishments and where you're going in the practice and attainments and levels of concentration, but to really try to meet this next moment fresh, new, completely, to have the complete. And then one of the things that you learn from Zen, I think, or one of the things that seems to come with Zen practice, is at some point the realization and the manifestation are the same thing. They're not separate from each other. So it's not a matter of realizing, understanding, and then acting in the world. But the two arise and occur together. That there is no realization without the manifestation. And there is no manifestation without the realization. So it lends itself, this kind of approach to life lends itself to a certain kind of, I was going to use the word magic, I don't know if that's the right word to use. Magic, you know, that life is always new and fresh and interesting. And what is this life we're living? To look anew. And I find often, you know, that meditation is one of those ways I can do that. Sometimes I'm amazed to open my eyes and see the same thing I've seen many times before. And it seems so new. What is this? So those are my thoughts for today. And completely inadequate talk, right? Because it's not always so. So what do you think about Suzuki Roshi's statement? The most important thing is to find out what the most important thing is. What do you think of that? How do you understand that? Maybe in ways I haven't expressed myself. Beautiful. So the most important thing is always changing.
I see it as a process is important, not the destination.
So the process is important, not the destination. Yeah, beautiful. So sometimes I emphasize that spirituality has a lot to do with how we are, more than what we are, or where we're going. How are you at this moment? What's the process? Thank you.
ongoing like creation itself, and if we had the final answer, it would become boring.
It might,
and it may not be necessarily so.
I think that any kind of final answer, you know, what I'm about to say probably isn't so too, but any kind of final answer, final understanding of what reality is always changing and unfolding and evolving and stuff like that. So there's always something outside of that understanding. And so then, you know, sometimes it's the next generation that comes along and says, wait, there's something outside of that understanding, something beyond that. And so then they, you know, those old guys, they don't understand, you know. They're stuck in their fixed views. And then sometimes it takes a new generation to kind of be able to see things afresh and new and question the fixed views. Yes?
It's focusing on the searching rather than the knowing and the having. It's the looking for it, the wonder, the curiosity.
So focusing on the searching rather than the knowing. It's really, I found that it's, when it's going well, that the endeavoring of practice, the curiosity, the interest, the investigation, the discovery, is even when there's nothing to be discovered yet, I haven't realized anything, just the very endeavoring to do that is deeply satisfying. I think maybe it's, you know, it's innate capacity, innate, you know, but faculty of many people is this faculty of, you know, interest, you know, discovery. What's this? What's this? You see it's, you know, really dramatically sometimes in young children. Yeah.
I find it very humbling in a good sort of way. Just seems like the more I do the practice, the more humble I become, you know, and less sure of anything.
So she says.
Said once it's like getting dumber.
Getting dumber. Is that that? We don't put that on the advertisement. So she says she finds that the practice makes her humbler in a good way, and less and less that she's sure about things, is there appropriateness in becoming less sure about what's happening? Is there wisdom to that? And maybe, you know, it could, ideally, I hope that kind of humility or that kind of not knowing kind of maybe can go together with a greater understanding. They're not exclusive of each other. As we develop more understanding and clarity about what this life is that we're living, that it can go together with. Sense that, you know, how much you don't know, or that things are always new and fresh. Yes?
I think if you're less sure, you suffer less. There's less suffering because you don't have as much of an expectation of certainty. So it's just like saying, well, I don't know, or you're just not setting yourself.
Yeah, that's true. Though some people who are so sometimes have had a very difficult life, the idea of not having certainty causes more suffering than having certainty. And sometimes, as an intermediate phase in a person's life, it can be very useful to have something you really hang on to, something that's really sure and stable. And I've known people who, it's dangerous because you don't ever know whether what you're holding on to is reliable. So sometimes it doesn't always cause more suffering. It can be intermediate to lesser suffering to hold on. But ultimately, I completely agree with you. And Suzuki Roshi, in his chapter, in his book, the chapter that's called Not Always So, encourages us to practice as if we're dying. And he says, as if you're dying, there's nothing anymore you can rely on. Yes.
The search for the most important thing. It reminds me of a saying I once heard, which is that don't seek to be like Jesus. Seek what Jesus sought.
Nice. Beautiful. Yes.
Everything that we have discussed, we still come back down to the most profound question. Are we the same person today as we were yesterday?
Do you have an answer for us?
We never are.
Never are.
What you might gain in the clarity and the wisdom every day is a learning experience.
Yeah. So it takes a certain presence then, a presence of mind, to discover what's new. Who are you? And in Soto Zen then, they have a kind of different kind of way of talking about self than the Theravada tradition. Theravada tradition tends to talk mostly about the self as there is no self. That's kind of the worldview, the frame of reference that they're kind of using the word self in. And so Zen, kind of things evolved quite a bit in Buddhism. By the time Buddhism came to Japan, they have a different frame for understanding self and what they're talking about. And sometimes in Soto Zen they'll say that the self is relational, that you only really discover who you are, who the self is, in the manifestation, in the relationship, in the activity of engaging in the world. Engaging in the world, the world mirrors back who you are. So Zen Master Dogen, he has a very famous quote, or a very statement that's become very famous. To study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And the last line is very interesting. And it's usually mistranslated into English. The last line should be translated literally. To forget the self is to be confirmed by all things. To be confirmed. You find out who you are when you forget the self and let all things tell you who you are. And that's always going to be new. Anything else? Did we settle that matter? Well enough for one night? And So this is the beginner's mind. If you want to take a look at it, it's right here. It's Suzuki Roshi's calligraphy. Thank you very much. Good night.